Court.
Mr. Taylor, good morning. You may proceed.
Have a seat.
No, you may. I think
no, you may proceed.
Sorry.
I'm sorry. I didn't make myself clear. No, you go right ahead.
Thank you, and may it please the court. Jonathan Taylor for the plaintiff's appellants, cross appellees, Dr. Michael Babelsick and Kathleen Skelly. If I may, I'd like to reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal. This appeal raises two issues. Number one, is General Motors entitled to judgment as a matter of law, despite the jury's liability finding against it? That's a question about the meaning of Rule 50. And then number two, if GM is not entitled to judgment as a matter of law, did the district court clearly abuse its discretion by conditionally granting a new trial limited to damages only? That's a question about the meaning of the compromise verdict standard. The answer to both questions is no, and I'd like to begin with the first, if I may. GM is not entitled to judgment as a matter of law under Rule 50 because the jury, as required by the instructions and the special verdict form, entered a liability verdict based on its express findings that GM was, quote, negligent in the design, close quote, of Dr. Michael Babelsick's van because it failed to adequately test the seatbelt system, and that this negligence directly caused his injuries. You'll find those findings at pages 3 and 4 of the addendum. GM, this is really critical, did not object to either the instructions or the verdict form that required that liability be entered based on those findings.
It's under Missouri law, right?
That's correct.
Does Missouri law allow for a liability finding based solely on a failure to test? In other words, doesn't it also require that there be some other something that would have prevented it?
Sure. There's no obligation to test. Or there might be an obligation to test, but there's going to be no causation if there's nothing wrong with a product, right? If you test a safe product, you find out it's safe, a manufacturer exercising reasonable care is not going to do anything different, right? The jury obviously didn't find that here. But
say that there's a duty to test. They breached the duty.
Right.
Approximately caused the accident.
That's right.
Now, that's the cause. Is that recognized in Missouri?
It is recognized.
And then how is that distinct from a strict liability? Because what happened here is the district judge just said, okay, you didn't find strict liability. It means it's not unreasonably dangerous. Therefore,
right. It
could not have a negligence claim.
Right. And I'd like to take on that last point real quickly, because I think that's really the only question this court has to confront, which is whether under Rule 50 you can credit some of the jury's findings and then use them to nullify other findings. Because what I think the real thrust of the argument that the other side is making is that the findings are somehow inconsistent with one another. And had they preserved that argument, the remedy would be a new trial on all issues. It wouldn't be judgment in GM's favor. And if it's not an inconsistency argument, then surely it must be an argument that somehow the instructions are flawed or the verdict form is flawed. Another argument that they have waived, and the remedy for that as well, would be a new trial. But they're actually making the argument that even though they didn't preserve these other arguments, that they actually somehow are entitled to a remedy that they couldn't get had they preserved them, which is victory in their favor. And there's no precedent for that. The only question that the court has to answer when it's confronted with a renewed motion for judgment as a matter of law under Rule 50B is the same question that they confront when they first have to ask whether the original motion should be granted. And that is, as the Supreme Court explained in Reeves, and as this court's cases have made clear, is the evidence taken as a whole in the light most favorable to the non-moving party enough to allow the jury to find in favor of that party? And if it is, that's the only question that you answer and you deny the motion. Anything beyond that is really a question about whether the findings can be harmonized or about whether the instructions are flawed. And the remedy for that is Judge Bates has recognized, as the Third Circuit has recognized in Mosley, and most, I think, squarely, the 11th Circuit in Cheney, recognize the remedy is a new trial. And if a judge instead grants judgment for the losing party by crediting some of the findings and using them to nullify others, that's reversible error. And I think here, if you ask the right question, which is there enough evidence at trial to allow the jury to find in Dr. Babelsick's favor, the answer would be yes. It's the same answer the district court gave twice before it submitted the case to the jury. And this is a negligence case. It's a case about causation and reasonableness and defect and, you know, a bunch of other things that under Missouri law are really quintessentially jury questions. And our side put on evidence showing that GM was aware of the unique risks posed by rollover accidents.
Okay, let me interrupt you. I let you go on this because you weren't quite answered my question. Jim says you have the McIntyre case, which is an older case. It's 1978.
That's right, yes.
That says, you know, you can't have both strict liability or negligence case if there's not a strict liability defect.
Right.
The laws, your argument is the laws change from there, and that's my question, is Missouri law at the time you tried this case, can you have a finding of negligence even though you find that there's no strict liability?
You absolutely can. I think this court recognized that a couple of years ago in Stanley versus Cottrell in 2015. It said that, quote, negligence and negligent design and strict liability are, quote, two distinct claims requiring proof of different legal elements. And the Missouri appellate courts have made that clear as well. So in Rich Creek versus General Motors, for example, the court made clear that even if the jury found for the defendant on strict liability, the plaintiff can still prevail under a negligent design theory. So I think it's quite clear that whatever the state of Missouri law was in 1978 when this court had to make an Erie prediction in McIntyre, it's quite clear now that Missouri law does draw a distinction between those two. And if you go to page 41, I think at footnote two of our brief, we cite some cases showing that this court's understanding of Missouri law in 1978 has been outstripped by subsequent cases applying Missouri law. Now, there's also the question of the correctness of this court's decision in McIntyre as a matter of Rule 50. Now, to our knowledge, no party in McIntyre made the argument that Rule 50 would prohibit the court from crediting some of the findings and using them to nullify others. And I think it's certainly clear now, if it wasn't clear then, based on this court's cases and based on Reeves and based on basic knowledge about the way in which Rule 50A and B interact, that because Rule 50A has to be submitted before the case goes to the jury, a Rule 50A motion has to be made before the case is submitted to the jury.
Let me see if I understand your argument.
Yes.
Will you agree with me that the negligent design can't be based solely on a failure to test, that there had to be something that they could have done that they elected not to do? Okay, so we agree with that. And then I think you're saying the mistake the court made was to look at the jury's findings, because under a renewed 50B, you can't do that.
Right, exactly.
And so what you're saying we should do, I think, is look at the record and see if the record supports whether there was or was not an alternative design that could have been used.
I think that's right. But
if the evidence is sufficient, then we reverse and reinstate the judgment, or you get a new trial?
I think you reinstate the judgment as to liability. Now, then, of course, then we would have to confront whether you would have a new trial just on damages or on everything, and that would turn on the compromise verdict question, and I can turn to that in a second. But I think
Are you arguing alternative design, or are you arguing there has to be a defect?
So under Missouri law is quite clear that you don't have to actually point to an alternative design. I think that is clear from the Moore case from 2011.
Yeah, but the failure
obviously
to test
helps
goes
by showing.
Yeah, you got to have a defect.
You got to have
the
something's got to be wrong with
negligence.
The design. That's exactly right.
All right. Let me ask you this: this jury instruction on strict liability says defective, unreasonably dangerous,
right,
rather than defective and unreasonably dangerous,
right,
the language I'm more accustomed to. Is that typical of a jury instruction in Missouri?
It is, because that's the phrase that the strict liability statute uses, and the statute itself doesn't actually define that phrase. And so
the question is, can a jury find that, yes, there's a defect, but it's not unreasonably dangerous?
I certainly think that's one reasonable way of looking at, of trying to harmonize the findings. Again, I don't think...
Well, is that possible under Missouri law?
It is possible. Of course, if it weren't possible, then this would be an argument about how they're inconsistent. It's inconsistent to find, on the one hand, that the failure to test directly caused the injury, and then on the other to say there's nothing wrong with the design. Because if there's nothing wrong with the design and you test it, you're not going to change the design, and it's not going to change anything in terms of preventing the injury. But so I think if you're talking about whether these have to be harmonized, that's a question I think that we would be confronting if GM had preserved the inconsistency argument.
Doesn't the strict liability statute also say defect unreasonably dangerous during, I can't remember, reasonable use or something like that?
Right, right. And the other
why isn't your argument to say, well, reason what happened here was not the reasonable use. Reasonable use is you don't roll your car down the road. That driving it, it's free of, it's not unreasonably dangerous in reasonable use. I'm just saying that I'm wondering why you don't put the emphasis on reasonable use.
Well, in fairness, I do think that, driving a car and, that's obviously reasonable use. And if there's some sort of collision, that's a foreseeable situation for a manufacturer. And then if there's a rollover that occurs, that also is foreseeable. And GM here was aware of the risk that were posed. And that's really what negligence focuses on.
I know. That's
on the conduct.
That's lawyer talk. You're arguing against yourself. I'm looking at it from a jury's perspective.
And that might be another...
Which is, the jury looks at that definition and says, well, this wasn't reasonable use. Nobody reasonably drives their car down the road, crashes it, and rolls it. We look at it as lawyers. We say, oh, yeah, that has all these ramifications.
Right.
Is a seatbelt case.
It's a seatbelt case.
The seatbelt protection doesn't even come into play unless there's an accident.
That's right. That's right. And I think really the theory of our case here at trial was that the seatbelt, what made the seatbelt defective was that the flaw in the design was that in a very, very slow speed rollover, it allowed the occupant to fall out of the seat with enough force to hit their head on the roof and break their neck. And that there were designs available to GM that they were aware of that they could have implemented. And had they done some testing, they would have seen the results and they probably would have implemented one of those designs. Now, I think the best way to read the jury verdict is it says, we're not going to mandate that the manufacturer adopt a particular design, whether it's the pretensioner or the all belts to seat system or something else. But we are going to impose on them some obligation to do something to fix the problem. There's a difference between a problem and a solution, and the manufacturer might have a lot of flexibility as to the solution, but I think what the jury is saying is that there was a problem and that GM was under some obligation to fix it, and had they fixed it, it would have prevented the accident. That, I think, is certainly a rational or not an irrational way of reading the jury's verdict here.
Is there truly a defect without an ability to remedy the defect?
There might be. I mean, I think that if there's no alternative design that could really...
What, you can't sell the car?
That would be one... I guess that would be the question, right? If you sell... Or you can sell it, but then you have to incur the costs of any harm that is done as a result of some, reasonable use of the product. That's the theory of strict liability. So it's sort of on the manufacturer to make that decision. But here, of course, we do have several alternative designs. One of them, I think, was in use in the vast majority of other vans, and yet GM itself didn't put that design in this particular model, though it did in the light-duty version of the van. And then a few years later, it did put it in this model. And I think when you take all that together, there's enough for a reasonable jury to say this is negligent conduct. And then you look at the expert testimony that our side put in, Mr. Sicker, and he said that had GM implemented one of these other design technologies, it would have solved the problem.
The problem is that it's sort of counterintuitive to us, I think, or at least to me, to reject the jury saying that none of these were available or were negligent not to use any of those.
Right, and I guess to the extent that that was a concern, it should have been made by objecting to the instructions or the verdict form, or at the very least, through some sort of motion through some objection on inconsistency grounds that would have given the jury a chance before it was too late to say what it was thinking and maybe to change its verdict. But and even if you had done that, I think that the only remedy would be a new trial, unless the jury went back and said, I guess we have a better sense of what is required of us now, and we're going to find there's no liability. But here to now on appeal say that the losing party at trial somehow can win the case as a matter of law, even though the jury entered a liability finding against it consistent with the instructions and the verdict form, and in the face of no motion on inconsistency grounds, I just don't think that has any precedent or common sense to recommend it. And if I may, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Shaw. Morning.
Morning, judges.
May proceed.
Judgment as a matter of law should be affirmed here because there was insufficient evidence that testing would disclose that the proposed alternative designs would have prevented the injury. At trial, appellants claimed that the van's seatbelt restraint system was in a defective condition, unreasonably dangerous, because the appellant's alternative designs would have prevented the injury. The jury found that the van's seatbelt restraint system was negligently designed solely because it was not adequately tested. But testing is pointless unless it discloses that an alternative design would prevent the injury. Therefore, this court must determine whether there was sufficient evidence that testing would show that the alternative designs would have prevented this injury. And if the evidence is insufficient to show that testing would have prevented the injury, that it would not have disclosed this allegedly defective condition, there can be no negligence for failing to test.
Well, do you agree that we should disregard the jury findings in that regard and look at the actual evidence and decide whether it's sufficient?
I think there is some case law that indicates that the court could have looked at the jury's findings, but I think in any event, this court's review is de novo.
Generally speaking, though, it's pretty clear that the renewed 50B has to be on the same basis as the 50A, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And that, of course, since a 50A is made before a jury makes any findings, would mean you can't consider the jury findings, right?
I agree, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I think that if the court looks at the record below, the court will find that there was insufficient evidence to support the verdict in this case.
Did the district judge, as I recall, did the district judge say that they thought that was sufficient evidence to support the negligent finding, but then got off into this inconsistent verdict?
It's a little bit difficult to follow the district judge's findings. At one point, he does say that there was insufficient evidence to support the verdict, but he said that there was sufficient evidence to find that there was no testing. But the point this court must determine is whether or not the testing, if done, would have shown that these proposed alternative designs would have prevented the injury. Otherwise, there's no point in testing.
Did the district court do that at all, other than, and did it look at the jury? Did it just rely on the jury findings, or did it actually look and assess whether the evidence was sufficient?
It's really not clear, Your Honor. It appears that the district court judge heavily relied on the jury's findings.
You agree with me now that was probably not the right thing to do.
That probably was not the right thing to do, but whether he did that or not, this court's review is still de novo. And this court...
We should then look at the underlying evidence to see if the testing would have resulted in something that could have prevented the accident.
Exactly.
Or the damage, anyway.
That's based on their expert, the plaintiff's expert?
Yes.
And it seems like that was kind of a thin part of their case, but their expert, you're more familiar than I am, but what did their expert say? Why? How do you attack their expert saying they could have tested it? These procedures, I think there were three of them were available to put in there, and if they had, I think he said that this would not have happened. The injury would not have happened.
Well, let's take a moment and discuss that testimony, Your Honor, because the appellant's causation testimony, which was largely based upon their expert, Mr. Sicker, amounted to no more than rank speculation at best. At trial,
there's a difference between saying there's no insufficient evidence and then it was speculative. And what I'm trying to get to is whether they had any evidence of that, and they say they did. And then I'm wanting to know, are you saying they didn't, or are you just saying it was speculative?
Well, let me point out what evidence they had, Your Honor, and I think it's appropriate to say that it was speculative evidence. At trial, they presented, as you noted, Your Honor, that there were three alternative designs available. And their causation expert, Mr. Sicker, testified that some combination of these alternatives would have prevented the injury. But most significantly, Judge, he did not testify that testing would have disclosed that these alternative designs would have prevented the injury here. Mr. Sicker is asked at Volume A, page 89, beginning at line 6.
Okay, let me interrupt you. You weave this into wherever you want, but I thought there was also testimony that GM did do testing in two later years, and I don't remember, but later years, and they did find out that this worked. So how did that later testing plug in? So go ahead and fill me in on that.
Let me tell you about that. Well, there is some conflation going on here, Your Honor. There was some testing before, some 20 years before, of a 1983 Chevy Malibu, some inconclusive testing that you will see when you review the record that Mr. Sicker is unwilling to say that that evidence shows that testing would have revealed that these alternative designs would have prevented the injury. The subsequent testing only showed, in effect, that in a rollover situation, people will hit their heads in a rollover vehicle. The evidence they must produce, Your Honor, to sustain the verdict in this case is that the proposed alternative designs would have prevented the injury if and testing would have disclosed that. But they don't have any testing that would disclose that, and their expert, Mr. Sicker.
I thought their argument was if GM had done the testing that it did in the subsequent years, it would have disclosed this, and then they would have used the alternative designs, one or the other.
That is
maybe confusing their case, but I thought that's what it was.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that is their argument, but they don't have evidence of it, and their expert, Mr. Sicker, admits that. And I can point you to that testimony.
He didn't tie the subsequent testing to the...
No. Let me read his testimony to you, and you tell me. He is asked, you haven't tested your system that you're proposing to this jury in a GMC Savannah van in any way, shape, or form, have you? Answer, I have not tested my system in a GMC van. That is correct. Or in any other motor vehicle. Any other actual motor vehicle, not in a vehicle, no. At volume 4B, page 78, line 5. Question, and nobody else has tested what you are proposing in this van either, correct? Answer, not that I'm aware of. Mr. Sicker admits that he doesn't even know what would happen at such a test had he or anyone else conducted. Further, he is asked at volume B, page 78, lines 19 through 23. Question, you don't know what would actually happen if anybody tested your proposed alternative design. You think you know, but you don't have anything more than that. Answer, I know, I agree. Your Honor, I think I know is speculation. And appellants like their expert don't have anything more than a maybe, a guess, and a possibility, and speculation is insufficient evidence to support this verdict. Their expert never says that testing shows that his proposed alternatives would prevent the injury, and he can't say that testing would show it because he never conducted the tests, and the tests show it.
He never did, but I thought the linkage was that when GM did the testing, they showed, GM itself showed in the later years that they needed one of these seatbelt adjustments to designs to keep people from hitting their heads.
No, that is incorrect, Your Honor.
Okay, what is it about the subsequent testing that GM did, and how does it fit in here?
The subsequent testing shows that in some circumstances that other devices... Hold on just 1 second.
Okay.
He was a trial attorney, Judge. Subsequent testing was testing devices and technology that were not available at the time this van was manufactured. It was testing sensors for rollover pretensioners. And the rollover pretensioner is not what this expert was advocating under any circumstances. He was...
So it was testing other designs?
Yes. Yes. Okay. So it has no application to this case at all. So the proposed alternative designs that were recommended or suggested in this case were not tested. And their expert admits that. So appellants in their brief, you will notice, Your Honor, rely on a single statement to support this verdict. And it's at page 36 of their opening brief. They say, quote, that there were designs available that would have prevented plaintiff's injuries. That's all. But that is vague and speculative and woefully inadequate to support this verdict, particularly where no testing was conducted of these alternative designs, and no one says that testing would have disclosed the allegedly defective condition. The evidence is entirely insufficient, and judgment as a matter of law was appropriate because the record does not support this verdict.
Joshua, wasn't the problem here that the jury instructions and the verdict form allowed the jury to impose liability based only on inadequate testing?
Well, I think there is an argument that can be made that there may have been an issue with the instructions. There may have been an issue with the verdict form. But that is irrelevant to the analysis here. There still must be evidence that supports the verdict.
Right. I understand that. But shouldn't your client or whoever was representing your client have objected to the instructions and to the verdict form if it allowed the jury to do that?
And you are assuming also, Your Honor, that the objection would have sustained and the incorrect instruction would have been given.
It would have been preserved at that point.
But we're not arguing, Your Honor, that there was an improper instruction. The evidence still must support the answer that the jury gave. And if there is insufficient evidence to support the verdict the jury rendered, it cannot stand, and judgment as a matter of law is appropriate. The idea that there was some sort of waiver here in this case is, I think, an argument, Your Honors, that...
Well, I just wonder who should pay the price for allowing this to be submitted this way and allowing the jury to make a finding of liability based solely on inadequate testing.
Well, I think it's incumbent upon the court to determine whether or not there's sufficient evidence to support the jury's findings. When the jury answers a question, whether... the law does not include, or the instruction they received includes all of the elements or not. The court must determine whether or not there is sufficient evidence to support it.
Counsel, at the close of the plaintiff's case, the court asked the plaintiff at that point to advise the court of what the theories of liability were that would be submissible. Were you in any way impaired in your ability to make a motion at that time, given that late exchange?
Well, I think, Your Honor, when that exchange took place, it was clear that the court understood, at least, that there was an issue regarding whether or not there was sufficient evidence to support the verdict or to support submission. And so ultimately, I think any argument that there was a waiver because there was not an objection to the instruction or there was not an objection to a perceived inconsistency in the verdict, I just think these are straw arguments that are raised by the appellant in this case because they have not presented to you any evidence or they have not presented to you sufficient evidence that would support the verdict that the jury reached.
Also, the record is a little unclear as to exactly when you found out whether Missouri law or Minnesota law would apply. When did that happen?
Well, I think there was always an understanding that that there was the substantive law of Missouri and the substantive law of Minnesota would have played a role in how the instructions were given and what instructions were going to guide the deliberations in this case.
You didn't try the case, but do you know when the court I mean, obviously, the court's written order in that regard is much later.
Yes.
But do you know when the court made it clear to counsel which law you were dealing with?
No.
And do you know if that impaired your ability to make a motion?
I don't believe that it did, Your Honor.
Okay, let me see if I can narrow this down. So what you're saying is all this about Rule 50 and so forth, really it all boils down to your saying that our court needs to do the de novo review to see if there's sufficient evidence to establish, to go to the jury on the negligence claim.
Yes.
Period.
Yes.
Okay. So then we got to go back and read through the record. I'm not complaining. I'm just saying that we're not getting into all this legal mumbo-jumbo about inconsistent verdicts and all that. You're just saying, is there sufficient evidence? That's your perception of where we are.
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And I think everything else is irrelevant because at the end of the day, when judgment as a matter of law is granted, this court must conduct the de novo review. And, you know, I think it's just kind of a bright, shiny object to dangle out there and say, well, what we're actually arguing is that there was instructional error. And what we're actually arguing is that the verdict was inconsistent. Ultimately, this court must determine whether there was sufficient evidence that testing would have disclosed that these proposed alternative designs would prevent the injury. And the evidence does not support that.
Got it. Okay, we'll look at the record.
Yes.
So, you have more time, but it...
Well, I suppose, Your Honor, given that we have additional time, that I should address the issue of the district court's decision to grant a new trial as to damages only. And I would only say that the district court can only grant a new trial as to damages only when the verdict is based upon sufficient evidence and made in accordance with the law. And that's the Hadra versus Herman Blum consulting case. A new trial as to damages only under the circumstances of this case would be improper and unjust.
Well, are you saying that, though, that if we find there's sufficient evidence to support a negligence claim, then it should go, there should be a new trial on damages?
I'm saying there should not be a new trial on damages only. There should be a new trial as to all of the issues and not limited to the issue of damages. The Hogg versus Grimm case, Your Honor, says that a new trial as to damages only is improper where there is good reason to believe that the inadequacy of the damages was induced by an unsatisfactory proof of liability. And a new trial as to damages only can only be when the jury's verdict is based upon sufficient evidence and made in accordance with the law. Well, we know here that there was insufficient evidence of a defect that would have been revealed by testing, that the jury's findings were not in accordance with the law, and therefore a new trial as to damages only would be improper and unjust. And either, as the appellant has suggested, the instruction was not a correct statement of the law or a complete statement of the law, or there was insufficient evidence to support the verdict in this case. Either way, the verdict was not in accordance with the law. And I think in examining the record here, judges, you will find that this odd chronology of deliberations and the verdict itself show that there was a compromise verdict. It's interesting to note as well that appellant originally agreed that this would have been a compromise verdict. But the course of deliberations, including the length of time and the question that was submitted to the judge, the lack of more specific defect findings, and the very specific damages awarded totaling exactly $1 million all add up to a situation where this jury just wanted to give the plaintiff something, even though that there was inadequate evidence of liability. Thank you, judges.
Thank you. Mr. Taylor, you've got about 5.5 minutes.
A few quick points in rebuttal.
I'd like you to address the point of whether sufficient evidence. I think hopefully we have at least a liability issue narrowed down to whether there's sufficient evidence to show negligence.
Yes, I think we've whittled it down to that now, and both sides agree that is the only question that this court should confront. And in confronting that question and making that inquiry, I think the Supreme Court's decision in Reeves points the way. And what Reeves says is that when you're reviewing the evidence, the court should review the record as a whole, but it must disregard all evidence favorable to the moving party that the jury is not required to believe. So that would be GM here. Anything that's in the record, you view it in the light absolutely most favorable to the plaintiff. And if a rational jury could find that GM engaged in negligent conduct here and that negligence directly caused the injury, then you sustain the verdict.
What did your expert say, and what did these subsequent tests, what relevance did the subsequent tests by GM have to your expert's opinion and to your theory?
Yes. So I think the jury made two express findings that need to be reviewed here. One is that the negligent conduct was the failure to adequately test the design. I think there's clear evidence that there was no testing done at all on this particular model. So I think that piece is there's enough evidence to sustain that. And so now we're just talking about whether the causation finding has enough evidence in the record to sustain it. And I think really what you have to ask is there enough evidence for a jury to think that if GM had conducted testing as it did in 2007 and 2014, would it have seen that these seat belts were not performing properly? And we don't have to make a guess about that. We know the answer is yes. They would have seen that they're not acting properly.
And so then the only other question is, they were testing different designs.
Would they have done something different? And we do know also from some of GM's own testing during the 90s that they were aware that implementing different designs, a pretensioner, for example, or an all belts to seat system, could reduce the amount of excursion, that is the amount of space in which the passenger comes out of the seat, to under a couple of inches. And we know that Dr. Babelsick had 4 inches above his head here. And so I think there's plenty of evidence, and certainly if you read the expert testimony on our side in its entirety.
Do you agree, though, that it's not just a matter of whether the testing would have disclosed a problem?
Right.
It's a matter of also whether there's sufficient evidence that it could have been corrected?
Yes. Whether a reasonable, I guess the way I would put it is, would a reasonable manufacturer have done something that would have likely corrected the problem in here and thus not caused the injury? And so to answer your question earlier, I don't think liability was imposed here based on a bare failure to test, because there is the causation finding. And I think the only way to understand that finding is to say that the jury found that had a reasonable manufacturer here conducted some tests, seen the results, they would have decided to implement some change. And we know that GM has put a pretensioner in this van, I believe, now. And so,
but do we also have to find that there was sufficient evidence that there was a change available that would have worked?
Yes, and you could. Well, I don't think that's required under Missouri law. I think that is clear from the cases. And the Moore case I pointed to earlier, I think this court's case in Sappington from 2008 also makes that clear. But certainly, it's easier to make your case if you can point to an alternative design. Because if you can't, then you have to show that a reasonable manufacturer really wouldn't have sold the product at all. Now, that's a plausible theory, I suppose. But we did show that alternative designs here would likely have made the difference. And our expert had looked at the literature. He had looked at the test results in the lab. And I know GM wants to quibble with the methodology, but that really is a jury question. And our expert said that based on his own expert opinion, that had one of these alternative designs been implemented or some combination of them, it would have prevented the injury. Now, real quickly, just on compromised verdict, I want to stress that this court, to my knowledge, has never disturbed the lower court's on-the-ground determination that a jury verdict was not the product of a compromise, and it's a clear abuse of discretion standard. So, as this court said in Bosing, really a compromise verdict results when a jury unable to agree on the issue of liability, they compromise on damages. And we do know that the damages amount here is unjustifiably low, but there's just no evidence showing that the jury was deadlocked on liability. And so
you argue below that it was a compromise verdict?
We said that's one plausible reading. And I have to say in candor, I think it's a plausible reading. But that's not the standard here. I think it's also a plausible understanding that maybe the reason that the jury issued the unjustifiably low damage award that it did is that it thought that maybe Dr. Babelsick was at fault by getting into this accident in the first place. That was something that GM's trial counsel mentioned in his opening below, and he was admonished, and the jury was given an instruction on that to disregard the causal evidence of the original accident because it's not relevant under Missouri law. But it is possible that the jury would have taken that into account. So we just don't know. We've got plausible explanations on both sides, and that's why you defer to the district court's judgment. So if there are no further questions, I would ask that the district court's judgment or conditional grant of a new trial just on damages be affirmed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, it's an interesting case. The court appreciates your arguments, both here today as well as your briefs. And we'll look at the record, and we'll see what we find there. So with that, we'll take it under advisement.